final segment with the amazing Billy Carson, ForbiddenKnowledge.com. Coming up, Jay Dyer. We got a lot to hit. I'll be riding shotgun with him some. So, Billy, you wanted to get into all the UAPs more, but we got off into the big picture, which I think was probably the end of the day more important. But in the 5 minutes we got left, give us your snapshot about, obviously, some big disclosures coming. I think from all the priming, it's going to be disinformation. I think you kind of agreed, if not elaborate. Mm-hmm. What are you expecting and what's going on, just in a summation?
I'm thinking my hypothesis, based on my research, some people that I'm connected to, that we're going to get a completely different perspective on the nature of these UFOs and UAPs coming within the next 3 to 5 years. They want to take control of the narrative because us civilians are getting access to more technologies. We're launching CubeSats. You know, I've got friends that own their own satellites now, and I could just give them telemetry on any site on Earth, and they can give me the data of what's underneath that particular structure. Of course, without hitting any restricted airspace or whatever. And so now we're in a position where we're going to be able to gather intel and intelligence, and we're going to be able to use different types of systems that can detect multi-spectrum, ultraviolet, gamma rays, X-rays, microwaves, and see the universe in a way that they don't really show us, right? We can only get what they give us. And I think we're going to discover something within the next 3 to 5 years, big is going to come out. We're going to discover that not only are other beings exist within this universe, within this third dimension, but that also there are multidimensionals, higher dimensional beings. In other words, a being that might exist in a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, or higher dimension, they have the capability of interfering or in some way transitioning into a sliver of our reality. And some of the paranormal activity and some of the things we're seeing that we're perceiving as maybe even UFOs or UAPs in some way, not all of them, some of them could be a higher dimensional intersection. In other words, if I draw a line on a piece of paper, that's one dimension. Now, imagine if there were living beings, living one-dimensional people living inside the line. And then I put my finger on that line. What would happen? They would not perceive my finger because they can't. What they would perceive is an imprint of my finger as a flat circle within their reality. They would see a flat disc appear out of nowhere. They wouldn't be able to perceive the rest of my finger, and of course, not even my entire body. And so I think
they would
basically
see like a footprint.
Exactly. Yes. And so I think that some more evidence from what I see getting ready to happen within 3 to 5 years, much more incredible evidence to prove that there's a higher dimensional intersection or engagement that's happening here. And we're going to be able to get a sliver of evidence that's really happening.
I totally agree. In closing, you got to come back soon. About to say bigger picture.
Yes, sir.
I had a lot of psychic experiences growing up. But now as I've gotten older, it's gotten more intense. And generally in research, it's stronger when you're younger. I'm just kind of moving quick here. But from everybody I'm talking to and everything I'm seeing, isn't the psychic ability increasing right now? So I don't think it's just me.
Oh, yeah.
It's getting crazy. Like almost, it's like, this is too much. See what I'm saying?
It's increasing like crazy. And the reason why is because our solar system undulates up and down as it moves around that galactic arm. Now, when it undulates up to a certain point, it ends up being at what we call the galactic equator, directly in line with the supermassive black hole directly at the center of our galaxy. Extremely highly charged, fast charged particles are coming streaming directly at us. Very small muons and quarks and everything. Small particles that intersect with our body and they actually intersect with even our DNA and they change and alter the codes in our body. So in some strange way, the universe is intrinsically connecting with us and activating us and getting us to a higher dimension of consciousness and reactivating some of those dormant nodes. And it's giving us heightened psychic abilities, heightened levels of empathy, and even higher levels of intuition. So you're right. It is happening and it's happening right now. And we're in the process of this undulation and we hit the galactic equator within 2013 till now. We're here. And you're going
to
see more and more.
I've talked to high-level people in the government. That's what they say. And basically, it's like the alarm clock's going off.
Yes, absolutely. It's here. We have arrived at a point in time where we are the ones. We are the new ancestors. We are the new wisdom keepers. We are the new sages. And that's why I respect the work that you do, because it takes a lot of courage to step out there and be a pioneer of this information.
Billy, you're amazing. Let's talk soon. God bless you, sir.
I want to start with sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex.
This is rocket fuel. This is incredible. This is rocket fuel. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is a cocktail I drink every day. A squirt of ultramethylene blue and T3. You are insane if you don't get it. Okay? Well, listen. You are insane if you don't get it. I am a wrecking ball. I am obsessed with this. I can't stop. And now I'm having this. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is the truth. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. You understand that? Is that burning your brain?
I think I'm going to buy some methylene blue now.
TheAlexJonesShow.com.
From the front lines of the information war, it's Alex Jones.
Well, Billy Carson's a really smart guy. We got another individual that's well-learned and also street smart, and that's the great Jay Dyer about to take over here in just a few minutes. But we are listener-supported, so I've been so busy, and I got a bunch of interviews coming up. I don't even have time to do this. I'm going to cut an ad live on air for all the new specials, do it live. You'll notice what you see me say live right now will then be airing on the network because that's how we fund the operation. But all the products are amazing. They empower you. They enrich you. Even the T-shirts and stuff are exciting to wear out in public. You'll meet like-minded people. It's amazing. So I'm about to cut an ad right now, and then I'm going to hand the baton to the great Jay Dyer. There are billions of ways for people to be culturally, spiritually, politically, environmentally engaged. And there are millions and millions of different programs and podcasts and radio shows and things around the world out of the 10 billion people on this planet. But on the record, what we've done at InfoWars, and this is just the second leg of that at alexjoneslive.com, has changed the world. Our guests, our callers, our researchers, our reporters, and my overall futuristic analysis and view of the destiny of humanity, which I don't claim to be 100% accurate, but it's definitely proven to be a good template to observe the world, has had a giant effect, and the globalists do not like it. So when you share that local AM and FM station that you listen to and tell those you share it with to share it, it changes the world. When you say this is a forbidden information at alexjoneslive.com that has the free audio and video feeds and archives and shows and articles, you are literally going in the face of the censors and the tyrants. You're changing the world. It seems simple. It seems little, but it's not because we have millions of listeners and viewers. And if we can leverage that out to millions more and have them leverage it out, that creates the chain reaction. And all the great guests and hosts we've had on over the years who were already great, successful, they'll tell you how much more their shows blew up once they were on air here with this operation. We are here to get the next generation, black, white, old, young, to awaken to the epic time that we're all alive in right now and to take action. So your word of mouth is key, your prayer for the broadcast is key, and supporting us financially is so key. And we make it symbiotic where everything you get at thealexjonesstore.com will empower you, will enrich you, and will be an adventure. The Patriot Apparel, some of the best designs ever, limited edition for the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, are out right now. Right now, ladies and gentlemen. And this latest design, these limited edition, America, red, white, and blue on Sterling Royal Blue, 76, America 76, 250 years. That is a really cool shirt. I think it's going to be a bestseller. It just came out today. And all the other 250th anniversary limited edition shirts are available right now as well at thealexjonesstore.com. So be sure and check those out. And I thank you for your support. But wearing these out in public, meeting like-minded people, spreading the word, it's an adventure in and of itself, and it funds this operation, which is exposing the next pandemic, the next attempted lockdowns, the next big globalist war. You are financing your own future for a better future and better destiny when you keep this broadcast on the air. But you can also experience the InfoWar on the ground wearing these great shirts. Also, we have the new dual carbon platinum gravity fed filter, the highest quality gravity fed carbon filters that are the highest rated, cutting out all of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of horrible forever chemicals that are out there. And it has the highest quality stainless steel. Nobody has got a filter with better filtration. It's the highest rated, and nobody has as beautiful a filter as this, and ours is way under the price of competitors that are crap. This is the best. It's a home run by Bigley, our sponsor. We're so proud of it. Here's the issue. 1,000 of these came in. It sold out in 3 days. They got a couple thousand more coming in like late next week. Those are pre-order right now. They're going to be sold out soon, and then I'm going to stop promoting it until they get even more in because I don't like doing pre-order. But if you want to be at the head of the line to get these while you still can and not have to wait a month or so after that, get your order in now, right now, at thealexjonesstore.com. And while you're on the site, check out all the other great Patriot apparel, the super high-quality military-grade belts, all the great supplements and more at thealexjonesstore.com. Now, Jay Dyer, as always, kicking ass, best-selling author, researcher. 99% of what he does is just go off the globalist own books, their own statements, their own operations. And so he's about to do that. He never ceases to amaze. So Jay Dyer takes over now for the next 49 minutes. And then Harrison Smith, the War Room, live, takes over. Jay Dyer, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be with you. Today I want to talk about the inquiry that just occurred in the UK and the discussion of how Islam has been able to run so freely in the West, given the bizarre and tortured tale of the relationship of Islam to the West, and particularly to the United States over the last several centuries, and the British Empire before that. There's a couple of really good books that go into quite a bit of depth about this that help us understand how the Kalergi plan is coming into effect. It's not just Dr. Carol Quigley's writings. You know, in Anglo-American Establishment, he talks about the acceptance on the part of the elite in the West, the oligarchs of the West, to utilize this plan to really degrade and to demoralize and ultimately replace the existing European nation states in Europe, and then the native stock of the Americans in the West. And so they decided that Islam would be one of the best means of doing that in Europe. That has been adopted and spoken of not just by the Royal Society, who agreed to do the Kalergi Lord Curtis plan, but also in America. We have people at the OSS and the CIA, who we just completed on my channel, for example, The Old Boys, which was a history of the founding of the OSS and CIA and all the major players from Donovan to Wisner to Dulles to Angleton, and how they were all working directly with Kalergi. I didn't expect to see that in that book because it was written as another Council on Foreign Relations history text. And here we have them discussing the fact that, well, yeah, of course, we want to get rid of the existing European white people groups and replace them, because that would then break down the firewalls that are in the way to globalization. And there's different ideas and different competitive strategies for what the future global order would be. There was a Soviet NKVD version of the global order. There was a Bolshevik, Trotskyite, Leninist version of what the international order would be. There was a fascist Axis power version of what the world order would be. And there was a democratic capitalist Western American version that Quigley talks about. There's also an Israeli-centric version of the global order, which would appear to be on the rise since the alliance of the WASP Zionist position that the West found itself in after James Jesus Angleton, who was the big Zionophile, who decided that during the Cold War, we really needed to hitch ourselves to Israel as one of our main allies. And that's kind of what's put us in the position that we're in. But what about Islam? Islam seems to be this kind of chess piece that's used in these different conflicts. Islam has quite a different variety of sects, different groups. But why is it being so why is it being allowed to run so freely, especially in Europe and in the UK? And we find Islam being massively imported into Ireland. We find that anywhere you go, for example, I went to London in 2018. It was just mosques everywhere. Why is this? Is it just incompetent leftist politicians? No, this is a long-term strategy. And what's amazing is that when we read writings from 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, they all talk about how they would do this. And this is not antithetical. If I talk about Fabian socialists, that's not antithetical to Zionist interests. People always get this confused and they whine and bitch about it. It's Lord Rothschild and Lord Curtis, Lord Milner, who were the main proponents of Fabian socialism, which was just reformed Marxism. This is Western capitalist friendly Marxism. And that's, again, out of certain segments and sectors of the Rothschild circles. Now, not everybody in the Rothschilds and their circles were necessarily on board with Bolshevism. Some of them thought that Bolshevism was far too radical. They didn't want to go that extreme. And even when it came to the beginning of the Cold War in the 1940s, after the period of Lenin and Trotsky, Stalin realized that the policies of the Bolsheviks were so insane and so degenerate that the whole country was about to collapse. And so Stalin began what he called a Russian revivalist project. I'm not defending Stalin. I'm saying that even Stalin, as just a pure pragmatist, was able to realize that the Bolshevik policies were actually almost seemingly designed to destroy and degrade the country itself. And of course, we all know that a massive component of the Bolshevik belief system was Jewish, was Talmudic, and they believed that they were getting revenge for many centuries of Tsarist opposition, as well as perhaps even the old blood vendetta between the Khazars and the groups around them that they wanted to take vengeance for. So if that's one angle that we need to understand, then we have to understand, well, then how does Islam play into that? Well, Islam, as many of the rabbis have said, is the broom of Judaism. So we have to understand it's not just, I mean, Zionism is a crucial political position here, but ultimately Judaism is much older than Zionism, and Judaism is a Talmudic religion. It's primarily not based on the Torah and the prophets. It's primarily based on the Babylonian Talmud, which the rabbinic tradition sees as the only way or the only lens to understand or read the scriptures. So it's actually kind of above the Torah or the prophets. And rabbinic Judaism really solidified itself in opposition to Christianity in the first, second, third, fourth centuries. I'm not saying that Judaism didn't exist before that. I'm saying that rabbinic Judaism, when it became codified, a lot of its stances come out of anti-Christian stances of the first, second, third, fourth centuries. That's why the Babylonian Talmud is really codified and kind of collected together in the fourth, fifth centuries. So if we think about Islam in this situation, from the vantage point of the state, of the power elite, Islam is a tool to be used. And it's a very powerful tool because we have to think beyond warfare just being tanks and bombs or soldiers. Warfare is also ideological. It's also perhaps spiritual. It's also, I mean, in the sense that even if a state is atheistic, they can understand, like Stalin did, the need to at least have a church, even though the NKVD in his mind would run the church in Russia. At least some kind of moral stabilizing element was necessary for society so that it didn't just completely collapse into chaos and degeneracy. But from the vantage point of the state and the elites, particularly the Western power elite, even before the WASP Zionist Alliance, the CIA was already pretty dead set on a Middle Eastern approach, which was gradually moving away from Arab nationalism or pan-Arabism, the idea that you could modernize a lot of these countries and turn them into secular democracies or republics, but rather to then utilize the more radical elements. Now, we know that after 2017, the New York Times reported that Timber Sycamore, which is something that we were writing about, I was writing with people back even in 2012, 2013, 2014, writing articles about how we knew that the CIA was using, and perhaps also Israeli intelligence was utilizing, the radical elements of ISIS and those groups outside of and in the areas around Israel, but it was unclear what the project was called or what the name was called. By 2017, it's declassified. We know it was Timber Sycamore, and there was over $1 billion put into that. A lot of that had to do with utilizing Sunni ISIS-type groups to overthrow Assad, but also these types of groups are used, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And one of the first times I encountered this idea was when I read famous CIA operative Miles Copeland, his very rare, very difficult to find, I eventually ended up getting a copy, Game of Nations. And the game of nations is very important. In fact, in 1969, he wrote this memoir. I'm kind of surprised they let him write as much as he did in this memoir. Because you have everything from the admission of, yeah, of course we use the Muslim Brotherhood. Of course we use radical terror groups as proxies. Of course we utilize suicide bombers. He says it's a crucial tool in our arsenal. But beyond, and I do want to talk about a lot of these kind of exciting sort of, you know, movie, Hollywood movie style operations that he talked about. And yes, he is the father of Stuart Copeland and Ian Copeland. So this is the guy who's the dad of the, you know, the police, the drummer of the Police, and then booking agent Ian Copeland and drummer Stuart Copeland of the Police. So their dad is this high level CIA operative consultant who was stationed first in Syria, I think under Assad's dad, I'm going from memory, and then in Egypt with Nasser. And the first thing he says in the book, this is going to be very crucial for understanding that it's not just about these individual little operations. Everybody thinks about things kind of disconnected or disparate. Oh, we have this arrest of Maduro here, and then we have this coup in Ukraine over here, and then we have some other operation over here in Taiwan. And those things, all of these things are not disconnected. And it's not a conspiracy theory to talk about these from a macro perspective, because that's exactly what something like the CIA or the Mossad or whatever, that's why the British intelligence, they exist to do this, to collate and integrate all this information to kind of give a vantage point for the power elite in the West, the Five Eyes, et cetera, to know how to approach all of these different problems. And it's not for the benefit of the people. It's not for the good of the people. These are high-level technocrats and eugenicists. And what's amazing is that even in a book written in 1969, by a CIA operative and handler, even in 1969, he pretty much lays out the entire game plan and says, this is not really about modernizing Egypt or Syria because we care about anything to do with that. We're not there. In fact, he actually mocks the people that think that we're actually defending freedom and democracy and we're spreading capitalism to all these. That's not why we're doing any of this. He says that there's a long-term plan, which I'll talk about here in a minute. But the first thing he says in the preface, which I thought was fascinating, was he says mainline history is actually hidden from historians. Historians who are normie historians at the academic institutions that we have, they don't really know what's going on because they're actually sort of kept from things like, for example, the Council on Foreign Relations archives or the Rockefeller family's archives or the Warburg and Schiff archives. Right, because when you go to the archives as people who are allowed to sort of write these official histories, whether it's Quigley or Burton Hirsch or whoever, they typically get access to the archives. Collier and Horowitz, who wrote the big fat Rockefeller biography, they were writing that from the Rockefeller's family archives. And a lot of times historians don't necessarily have access. Sometimes they do, but a lot of times they don't. And he says that history is written by the intelligence agencies. It's not actually written by your average on the street, you know, local community professor who wants to write a history book. And a lot of these people say, he says they don't understand covert operations. And the whole idea of covert operations is that we have to be evil to fight evil. You've got to be more evil than the people that you're fighting. That's the only way, he says, to win these battles. And he says that, you know, people who come out of Harvard Business School and who go into these high level international relations situations, they might know what's going on, but the average historian or the local professor, they don't know what's going on. And how much less than would the journalists or the, you know, the establishment people know what's going on. The first really surprising thing, though, that didn't surprise me, but when I read this book, was the discussion about the what he calls the game center. So back in the 1960s, the CIA had its own little sort of war room game center, he calls it, where they were intent. Am I still here? Looks like it froze for a second, but we're good. He says that there was a satire book written that actually, whether they knew it or not, matches up perfectly to the CIA's game center. And he talks about the report from Iron Mountain. So if you don't know about that, that was a fictional book that was written that was outlining a high-level corporate international banking conspiracy that included the State Department, the CIA, and the Pentagon, and other agencies sort of collating together with some of the Fortune 100 to set up a future order, a sort of new world order. It's a classic sort of conspiracy text. And he says, although this famous book was written as a fiction piece, as a satire piece, he says, this is actually what we have. He says, we have at the Game Center an international strategy that we approach, whether it's De Gaulle or whether it's socialists in Venezuela or whatever. He says, we actually were already employing high-level computer game theory back in the 1960s to try to figure out through game calculations what conclusions the CIA could utilize to best approach any of these localized conflicts and problems. Am I still with you guys? It looks like I'm frozen. I can't tell if the Skype, I mean, with Zoom is frozen or if... Okay. So he goes on to discuss the fact that it's necessary to engage in massive lies and propaganda. That's the only thing we can do to win. He says winning is more important than anything. We win at all costs. And that, again, includes being more evil than the opponents. This is, again, you understand, this is the attitude and the strategy of the CIA in the 1960s. And this is all going to relate to where we are now with regime change in Israel. And this is why Israel has the same attitude. You understand that? So when we talk about, you know, why Israel just basically wants to kill anyone that disagrees with them or criticize them, it's because this is the same attitude that power elites get when they get to be delusional. And he says that, yeah, of course, our whole operation is about regime change. We want to engage in coups, assassinations, and et cetera, in any country that disagrees with us. He talks about it being a zero-sum game. It's winning at all costs. And he says, ultimately, the purpose of all this is that we're going to create a new order of the ages, a kind of a new order that will dominate based on Americanist and Western philosophy, or the Pax Americana, which takes over from the Pax Britannia. So that's the real vantage point and strategy that America has. That's how he ends the very first chapter with saying that we're here to set up a new world order. And again, this is not a conspiracy book. This is a guy who was running the CIA's operations in Syria and in Egypt during the Cold War. He says that our job as America, in reality, with our secret teams and our black ops, and by the way, obviously the same situation would apply to Israeli Mossad and their approach to these problems. We know from the Viktor Shravsky book that Mossad, for example, has an international network of what are called Sayanim, which Viktor Shravsky in the early 80s said was around 6,000 or so people that in any country, in any place, Israel could call upon for, or the Mossad or the IDF or whoever could call upon for whatever help they need in whatever way. And most of those people are sort of bound to have to help, even if they didn't want to. He says that we are the new empire. We've taken over the British Pax Americana. And so we're going to do what we want because that's the nature of the game. This is the great game, he says. He says also that we had a lot of problems. For example, he says, as a harassed planning officer of the State Department once said, we don't really have objectives, we just simply have problems. There were problems that arose. I guess the commercial break.
Plugged for about 90 seconds at the end of the first hour. Didn't plug any last hour. And I'd raise that point. I'd say, oh, no, I didn't plug. It's bad I didn't plug. But I didn't interrupt that guest. That's how we fund this operation. If I just plugged twice an hour, we've done the math, we'd have plenty of funds around this place. And I can then hire more crew, more stuff, but I don't do it, so we're almost in the red again. So be conscious about this and realize when you fund this operation, you are funding your insurance in the fight against tyranny. And the products really work because we want to sell you something that is going to be great, that's good for you, that blows you away. So you go, man, that Alex Jones was right again. Not just about what he covers and says, but the products. Our T3 iodine is not instant gratification. It takes about 2 weeks on average for it to kick in. It is the missing link. Most people are iodine deficient. The iodine that's in the environment, most of it's bound, meaning it's not atomic. It's not pure on the periodic table. It is bound to a whole bunch of other stuff, and you don't absorb it properly. This is atomic iodine. It does everything. Now, again, you die without oxygen in 4 minutes. Everybody knows this. 4 minutes without oxygen, the average person's dead. Some people quicker. Without water, you die in about 4 days. Out in the desert today, most people die in about 45 days without food. Now, why is that? Because the food has the vitamins and minerals in it. And I know I'm talking to you like you're 5 years old. I know most of you get this. For others that don't, iodine, you can look it up, is one of the essential elements that without iodine, you die. Now, in the 1920s, they noticed about a 15-20 point IQ reduction, particularly in the Midwest, and massive spikes nationwide of child deformities, birth defects. And they did a bunch of big government studies and found that people that lived on coastal cities and that ate a lot of fish had higher IQs and basically almost no deformities. And they went, oh, it's the iodine. So they started putting a cheap form that's bound, but you still get some of it, but sodium fluoride, I think someone, in the salts. When I was a kid, it still said Morton salts, iodine added. You know, the little girl with the umbrella, and it says when it rains, it pours. This is the super version of that. Just a few drops a day. It takes 2 weeks on average to kick in for the average person, and your skin, your stamina, your libido. I remember, like, gosh, time flies, like 18 years ago or something, I met Dr. Edward Grute, really smart guy, total visionary. And he said, listen, you need to start taking atomic iodine. And he'd come out with the only one. And he said, you should sell this private label. And I said, okay. He said, you know, you got some of those sunspots on your face. And I was like 38 then or so. And I'd have bad skin, but I did have some sunspots, brown spots and stuff that weren't freckles. You know, I call them liver spots. And he said, all this other stuff will happen, your libido, everything. He goes, it's about 2 weeks for it to kick in. And right at about the 2 week mark of the average person, you'll kind of feel crappy for a day or two. It's not like you have a cold or the flu, but you feel kind of groggy and tired. That's when it shifts in the cells, the mitochondria. And then a lot of toxins will get pushed out. You might even break out or something. But he said, after that, you'll feel incredible. 2 weeks later, I go, man, I feel like crap today. I have no energy. Lasts about a day. And then when I woke up the next day after feeling sick the day before, it was like I'd been carrying, you know, one of my kids on my shoulders. I'd carry them until they were like 5 or 6. Sometimes it'd be exhausting, but you take them off your shoulders, it feels so good. That's what it felt like. You're insane if you don't get this, and it funds our operation. And I only sell stuff that works, but it's not instant gratification. 2 weeks. Now be careful with it. Talk to your physician before, because if you've got some different thyroid issues, it can cause problems. In most cases, it helps, but you talk to your physicians. This isn't a game. And so a small percentage of people that can do some weird stuff. So be careful. I'm not selling placebo here. I only sell stuff that kick you like a mule in a good way. Be conscious about this and realize when you fund this operation, you are funding your insurance in the fight against tyranny.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Listening to an AJN Live frontline report. If you are receiving this transmission, you are the resistance.
Welcome back to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. Remind you that if you're interested in my books and my materials, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel, Jay Dyer. I do almost every day live streams, maybe every other day. We went deep into the KGB and the relationship to the Russian church and the CIA in terms of a big, long history lecture last night. You can check that out on my channel. But we also do all kinds of fun stuff. We do comedic stuff. We do debates. And that's at my YouTube channel, Jay Dyer. You can also follow me on X, Jay Dyer, and on all the other outlets. We're talking about the problems that arise and how the stance of the power elite handle these problems. And he says that we don't really have, this is the State Department saying, we don't really have problems. We have objectives. Problems arise from Zionist tensions, the attempt to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And then there was a response to try to prevent that. This was all part of the Middle Eastern game. And ultimately, this book, according to Copeland, notes that at that time, the decision really had to do more so with the American oil companies and who would get a placement where in the Middle East at that time. So that's a big part of what dominates the operations and what we do. At least this was in the 1960s in the Cold War. Nowadays, it seems to obviously be, at least since the 80s and 90s, really just the Likud policy. But he says that we bring, quote, democracy to the Middle East, but that's really a cover for the interests, the corporate interests. We're not really interested in bringing democracy. It's really about renovating or bombing and then renovating the countries to make them amenable to future markets. And he says, this was very relevant, at least to the last 8 or 10 years. He says, one of the first things that we engage in is rigging the elections. He says, we've gotten very adept, this is in the 1960s, at rigging elections throughout all these countries. And the elections, he says, really have to do with making sure that certain oil companies can go into certain countries. He says, literally, that we, quote, rig the elections for the oil companies. And democracy isn't even a real thing. Democracy is really just a cloak that's worn as a cover for going into all of these countries. He says that if you don't do this, then you lose. And so it's absolutely necessary to do. There is really is no other way, he says, than to do it this way. And he says that because Americans have an obsession with voting, he says they've been taught that voting is this great power, this great right that they have. He says we're able to utilize that and convince the Americans that when we send our troops and when we send even spies and missionaries, he says, to other countries, he says we utilize missionaries to do this. We tell Americans that we're doing all of this to bring freedom and democracy to these other countries, but we all know he's laughing and snickering at the CIA that's a joke. He says, we utilize Madison Avenue techniques of control. We spin the information. We utilize Hollywood as a means of soft power in the other countries. I think we played the clip many times. Maybe, I don't know if we played it on the fourth hour or not, but there's a classic clip, I think, from about 2001 where Netanyahu is talking to Congress and they're talking about regime change and ways to change countries. And he says, if you really want to change Iran, just beam 90210. Beam Sex in the City into Iran, it will change the culture. So they understand very well that Hollywood and soft power and the power of Hollywood is a crucial way to change the attitudes of these countries, at least back then. Maybe Hollywood's not that powerful now, but he says really that's just about managing trends and updating the countries to make them amenable to Western business interests. That's it. He talks about how at one point, the CIA thought it would be a good idea to try to find a Muslim version of Billy Graham, because if they could do that, they could unite, they thought, all the Muslims. And this was really a naive approach to how the Middle East works and how the tribes there are really incompatible in terms of their ideology. You're never going to find a single figure that could unite all of the Middle Eastern people. I mean, arguably, I guess Muhammad was the closest version of that, but now Islam is divided into as many sects as there are Protestant churches. So there's no way the CIA decided that they could find a Muslim Billy Graham. And so this is during the period when they began to move towards utilizing more and more radical versions of Islam. They found that to be a much more useful technique than to try to come up with a charismatic Billy Graham type of Muslim leader and unify the Arab peoples and then give them a modernized, industrialized situation. He says, yes, the CIA was absolutely behind Operation Ajax in Iran. That's well known now, but in 1969, that was not necessarily that well known. It was still kind of a considered conspiracy theory. We didn't do that kind of stuff. That was something that people wouldn't believe. He also mentions the importance of the Kinsey report, which is wild because the Kinsey report is something that he says was necessary for our research and for perhaps even psyops and ethnography to push gay stuff or to give the impression that, oh, everybody's gay on a scale, even though the Kinsey report, I think, has pretty much been totally dismissed and debunked. But he says that really provoking revolutions, agitprop, and then utilizing the coup, that's the classic technique that we engage in. He says that sometimes we might need to use the Muslim Brotherhood. Sometimes we might need to use local communist parties. It really just depends on what's necessary. So you have to understand this is above ideologies. As he said at the very beginning, it's a zero-sum game that's really about winning. He says, Egypt's defeat by Israel in 1948 was a traumatic experience, and the hatred of Israel was an important element in the thinking of those who were put in charge of the Egyptian revolution. This is where he begins to talk about the fact that Arab nationalism wasn't a real thing. It was something that the West was pushing to try to control and steer the Middle East. And he says that ultimately, the CIA was behind Nasser in this coup, and that it was a CIA deal that they really helped to set up. And he quotes Bertrand Russell all the time, which is wild because you wouldn't think he would be quoting Bertrand Russell, but he quotes him multiple times in the book. And he actually says that Russell's kind of the big picture idea guy, because his idea of depopulation and a global government is actually where we're going. So I'm going to skip past the section where he talks about the CIA coup in Iran and Operation Ajax. That's been discussed many, many times. We know that that's what happened. But he says that there's key elements that go with each one of these coups. And as you guys probably know, this gets eventually codified into the Gene Sharp color revolution model, right? So everything he's talking about later becomes the sort of color revolution model, where you have years of student activist planning. You have then the agitators and the riots that begin. You have somebody who comes in sometimes and does a sniping event and they kill somebody. And then this kicks off the coup, and they install whoever they want to bring in, the dictator, the whatever, the ISIS guy. He says that the U.S. was not just involved. And again, this would be pretty mind shattering to people reading this in 1969. He says we weren't just involved in paperclip and bringing over, Nazis and that kind of stuff. He says that we were also utilizing people from the SS to go and to train and set up Egyptian intelligence. And so we just covered this the other day on my channel, how Otto Skorzeny and Reinhard Gehlen, they were used by the OSS and the CIA to train the fledgling Israeli Mossad. So it's actually Hitler's guys that go and set up and train not just Israel and the Mossad, but they also go and they help set up the supposed haters of Israel, the Muslim Brotherhood, their intelligence apparatus as well, when they come into power in Egypt. And that's actually just an older strategy of the British Empire, right? The British Empire also had a strategy where at times they would support and help, the sort of radical Sunni groups, tried to use them as a proxy against the Ottoman Empire. But also you would have aid and support to the Zionists and the nation state of Israel via the Rothschild support for the founding of the nation state of Israel as well. So really the U.S. Adopts this strategy. And he says, what we do at the CIA in terms of doing all this is study public opinion all the time. It's Tavistock Institute, Walter Lippmann. We master all that stuff, put it into these 1969 big, huge computers, and then they spit out ideas about what we ought to do. So basically kind of an earlier version perhaps of AI that we are all akin to now. But he says, in many cases, the CIA aided and approved Nasser's operations. He wasn't really somebody that we were super concerned about. Because one of the main things that we wanted to get through Egypt was a 5-year plan where we could eventually get people taking birth control. Yes, you heard me right. The long-term plan in the case of Egypt and the modernizing and industrializing of Egypt, he said, we had a 5-year plan where we were going to take them through stages of updating the country. And he says the final goal was to get them to depopulation and birth control, because they were operating on what would become the Kissinger doctrine of depopulation and State Department Memorandum 200, et cetera. He says that we do this in phases, though. We don't try to immediately turn a country into a, first world, whatever. We go through the phases. He says we bring in a bunch of Hollywood stuff. We try to get them interested in Western culture, and then Western culture and the ideology of materialistic Western culture and so forth. He says that actually is the best for lowering population. He says that was the real goal. The phases of operations in Egypt, by the way, you'll notice the same is used in the West now. So the type of toxic culture that was fed to them back in the 1940s and 50s, it's the same toxic culture fed to Americans and people in the West now. Nasser would utilize television and psychological operations at the behest of people that were consulting from the CIA, telling him what to do. They would engage in false flag events when necessary. And by the way, there was opposition at times, but he just simply says that the CIA was never really worried about Nasser as if he was really going to be able to do anything. He says, we really control most of the Arab states in the Middle East throughout the Cold War. We would hype up, he says, the Soviet threat of them getting a foothold in the Middle East. They never really had a tremendous foothold. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars would go into aid from the U.S., but really this had to do with secret funding and with paying people off, black budget stuff, and that's how a lot of the countries are controlled, is through the aid money that the U.S. sends, which is just our tax money, right? So our tax money goes to basically into the pockets of all these stupid dictators so that they do what the corporations and the banks and ultimately now with the Zionists, what they want in these other countries. We see that clearly with Zelensky, for example. He says that the CIA would actually at times promote anti-Semitic, quote unquote, propaganda in Egypt to get the Muslim Brotherhood further hyped up so that they could be used against Israel, so that that could then support what Israel wanted. So they actually talk about hyping up anti-Semitism because it's very useful to the Middle Eastern game plan. He says the Muslim Brotherhood was one of our key tools that we would use, particularly in Egypt. And he says this is on page 184 and 185. He says, I can't even read my own writing, but he says that a lot of these Islamic regimes were necessary for basically using the radical groups. And he says that a lot of these people, when we study these groups, we come at them from a position of ethnography, and we study the culture and the race and the political structure. And he says that a lot of people don't have a belief in race, and this actually undermines and stunts their ability to do ethnography. Of course, we're told in the West that, you know, there is no such thing as ethnography or ethnicity, even though the intelligence agencies engage in this all the time. And if you talk about there being such a thing, you're an evil person, even though at the same time, all the other groups are allowed to have their ethnicity and their racial views celebrated with pride. He says, no. But you'll notice that the techniques that they were using are now being used on us. That's the point I'm trying to make here. So we think it's, this is so funny, the way that these dumb people were, these dumb Middle Eastern people were used. Well, all of those techniques are used on you. So the dumb Middle Easterner of 1945, just transfer that to the dumb boomer of today. There's a whole chapter on the usage and necessity of terror. He says, terror is necessary. We use terrorists all the time. And he says, we use them with finesse on page 204. He says, they're a great tool in our arsenal. They're absolutely necessary to fight the global battle. And he says, terror is a key component, for example, of planned coups, regime change operations, et cetera. So again, this book is fascinating. It's an amazing, I mean, if anybody who's a skeptic, if you were to read this book, I mean, there's no way you could come away thinking that, you know, all the stuff that I talk about, or Alex talks about, or whoever, like, there's no way you could be honest with yourself and come away without thinking that, okay, these guys are actually correct, because they write books admitting that this is how they do all this stuff. And again, I can't believe that in 1969, right, this was all kind of laid out in a book. I mean, Tragedy and Hope was around the 1960s as well, but I mean, I think just presumably people wouldn't be reading this. I mean, there's no other way I could even understand how they would write all of this in a book. And, you know, he concludes this chapter by saying that we're not doing anything different than anybody else. Everybody uses terror. All governments utilize terror. In fact, terror is a classic government strategy. Governments love to use terror because it terrifies the population and gets them in line. As long as they can keep the population terrified, scared, constantly agitated on edge, the population is much more pliable and willing to do what they're told. But interestingly, in the last few years, especially the last year, people are beginning to figure out that it seems like the terror really just benefits Israel. Like the terror narrative of the last 30, 40 years, whatever, it doesn't really benefit anyone except for one country in the Middle East. The rest of the countries seem to suffer under the war on terror. And it really seems to benefit not just Israel, but perhaps certain select corporations. He even says that we experimented with utilizing radio psyops and subliminals. He doesn't say whether the subliminals were that effective, but he does say that The Manchurian Candidate is a great book and movie to watch, he says, because there is some truth in the way that we approach operations when it comes to psyops in stories like The Manchurian Candidate. So perhaps, I mean, he doesn't say that there's Manchurian Candidate suicide bombers. The way he portrays the CIA's use of terror is that they wouldn't even need that, because you can find a host of low IQ Muslim guys that would be ready to die for the cause. So you don't really need to mind control them to get them to do that. Islam itself is a great form of mind control, at least the Sunni Salafi versions of it. He says at the end of the book, and this is the key point here, is that ultimately the purpose of going into these countries and to produce the revolution or the industrialization, whatever coup is necessary, yes, it's for corporate interests, but the corporate interest is not the long-term goal. It's not just to make money there. It's not just to create a new market. That's one element of it. He says, but the long-term is about the International Monetary Fund. It's about the IMF going in and really having control of these countries. And he says, you could read people like James Burnham about the managerial class. You could read about, because he says Harvard Business School and the CIA are going to use that strategy of Burnham's managerial class to run other countries, you see. So it's a corporate structure of governance that's installed in the other countries. Ultimately says, there's a whole chapter on chapter 12 about how Nasser ultimately aided the big oil corporations in Egypt. And that was really what a lot of these operations are about. It's not about terror. It's not about Islam. It's not about ideologies. It's largely about markets. And then he says that, but we also have a long-term game plan that goes beyond merely making market profits. He says there's a long-term game plan that includes the establishment of universities and the establishment of Western media in these countries and trying to create markets so that people can have a better standard of living. He says, but we don't care about them getting more money and having a better, more comfy life. He says the purpose of a higher standard of living is because every country that gets first world higher standards of living, their population drastically drops. And he says that's the ultimate goal here. He says we are mainly concerned with overpopulation in these countries. Now, again, note that that whole strategy has also been then turned on the entire West to basically decimate the population of the Caucasian peoples and their ethnicities in the West. And that was all by design, because that's what Kalergi said 100 years ago would be the plan ultimately. So yes, depopulation is about the world, and it's about a broader strategy of getting the world population down. But part of that, it also includes first targeting the people who would morally oppose that, and that's Christian peoples in general. And a large portion of those people are Americans, they're some of the Europeans still, they're Orthodox Christians, etc. And thus, the ethnicities that predominate, like white people, etc., those types of religions have to be first drastically brought down so that there is far less resistance to a global order. Why would that be the case? Well, again, Christianity is a major firewall to this approach. And so you have to damage and destroy Christianity in general. That's one of the reasons why so many of the churches are basically just NGOs and gay NGOs. That's what most churches are, just soft power, gay butt buddy NGOs. That's why they fly the gay flag, the trans flag, et cetera. They have trans bishops. Those are really just controlled, bought off things. Universities are the same thing, right? They're really there to brainwash the so-called intelligentsia. In fact, he began the book by even saying that they're not given real history anyway. They're given a fake version of propaganda history. And he says in the appendix, he says that there's a whole series of books that people can read to understand what the CIA's long-term game plan is. And he says it's really just depopulation. It's the teachings of the Bertrand Russell on the technocracy and having a technocratic state. He says you need to read... I'll show you some of the books he says to read. He says, read the Council on Foreign Relations reports. He says they talk about overpopulation and how we need to be dealing with this in every theater of conflict in every place on the globe. He says that you need to read about coups and revolutions and Rand Corporation reports. He says everything that we're doing at the CIA when we go into these countries is just following Rand Corporation reports about how to go about updating and changing the leadership of these countries. He says there's a whole reading list that I would recommend. He says read Bertrand Russell. He says to read, you can read books about cults and mind control, which is interesting. I wouldn't have expected him to recommend that, but he actually says books like The True Believer. And this is, he says, a British television series that dealt with David Frost and the character of Sirhan Sirhan. He says you can read about that in regard to how we utilize Arab people groups and people like Sirhan Sirhan and how we mind control and mess with those people, he says, on a major scale. He's not talking about whether Sirhan Sirhan was MKUltra. I mean, he could have been, but he says you need to read Herman Kahn, the famous neocon from the Rand Corporation. And he says the plans that we have for the world and for Egypt and these countries in the Middle East by the year 2000. So you understand, in 1969, he said the Rand Corporation had already strategized long-term game plans for countries like Egypt and how to get them to this, to the phases that he talked about, these 5-year strategies, 15, 20, 50-year strategies. He says also anatomy of revolutions, how the OSS runs the coups and the regime change operations. He says that's a very important book to read. He says the book The Ugly American is a great book to read. He says James Burnham's managerial class is a very important book to read to understand the operations and the regime change coups. And he says that ultimately, again, it's about depopulation and bringing the world into a technocracy. He says if you read the Rand Corporation's texts that deal with technocracy and ecology, he says this is very important because this ideology will dominate the future. We will bring the world into a technocracy at some point and in some way. And again, in order to do that, it requires the degrading and the devolution and the erasing of the native people groups. Because as long as you have people who have who are Irish, have a conception of being Irish, they're not going to be globalist. They're not going to be globo homo blob. Thus, you have to get rid of ethnicity.
Your arm been hacked off by a homeless person with a samurai sword? Try Shilajit gummies today.
A guy in Venice Beach just got his arm nearly hacked off by some tweaker with a samurai sword. And as of 4:15, he is still on the loose. And seemingly, the reaction from our local government is basically like, oh, shit, like, these things just happen. Like, this is our new normal. F that, dude. I want to live in an LA that is safe to go out, where I don't have to worry about walking around and getting my arm hacked off by some tweaker looking for drugs.
Sorry, I ate a Shilajit gummy. Sorry, I thought I could finish it before that clip was over. You caught me. Shilajit gummies, folks. We're not joking. They're very good. Shilajit gummies. Are you a leftist idiot that thinks it's normal that men get their arms chopped off with swords when trying to go to the beach in California? Shilajit gummies are for you. Consumers of Shilajit gummies, they know places to avoid. If you want to avoid having your arm nearly cut off by a sword in Venice Beach, California, you need to be taking Shilajit gummies today. I do love these things. They are really delicious, but they really do give you a kick. And you only get to take one. That is the worst part of Shilajit gummies, is you want to take multiple, but you're only supposed to take one. You can take more if you want. Also, I love the Modern World Survival Stack. A massive discount if you get three products together. It's the Shilajit capsules, the Atomic Defense, and the CMOS capsules, which are packed with vitamins, minerals to support overall wellness, thyroid health, and immune function. The Atomic Defense is for daily defense and cellular support, while Shilajit capsules support natural energy, stamina, and daily vitality. Get one or all of them now at thealexjonesstore.com. Share the links at alexjoneslive.com and on Rumble at thealexjonesshowlive.com. Shilajit gummies.
days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle. AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.